On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation. The Templeton Foundation supports academic research and civil dialogue on the deepest, most perplexing questions facing humankind. Who are we? Why are we here? And where are we going? To learn more, please visit templeton.org. The Templeton Foundation. Stay curious.
Compatibility is an achievement of love. It cannot be its precondition. Alain de Botton's essay, Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person, was amazingly the most read article in the New York Times in the news-drenched year of 2016. As people and as a culture, he says, we would be much saner and happier if we re-examined our very view of love. Nowhere do we realistically teach ourselves and our children how love deepens and stumbles, survives and evolves over time, and how that process has much more to do with ourselves than with what is right or wrong about our partner. How different would our relationships be, de Botton says, if the question we asked on an early date was, how are you crazy? I'm crazy like this. And then understood that the real work of love is not in the falling, but in what comes after.
We must fiercely resist the idea that true love must mean conflict-free love, that the course of true love is smooth. It's not. The course of true love is rocky and bumpy at the best of times. That's the best we can manage as the creatures we are. It's no fault of mine or no fault of yours. It's to do with being human. And the more generous we can be towards that flawed humanity, the better chance we'll have of doing the true hard work of love.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Alain de Botton is the founder and chairman of the School of Life, a gathering of courses, workshops, and talks on meaning and wisdom for modern lives with branches around the world. He first became known for his book, How Proust Can Change Your Life. His latest book is a novel, The Course of Love. So we did speak a few years ago, but on a very different topic, and I'm really excited to be speaking with you about this subject, which is so close to every life. And, as I've prepared for this, I realized that you've actually, I mean, I knew that you'd written the novel on love a long time ago, but you've really been consistently attending to this subject and building your thoughts on it and your body of work on it, which is really interesting to me. I mean, you wrote On Love at the age of 23, which is so young, and you were already thinking about this so deeply. I mean, I think this is the first line, every fall into love involves the triumph of hope over knowledge.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what's striking is that our idea of what love is, our idea of what is normal in love is so not normal.
It's so abnormal,
and
right.
So abnormal, and so we castigate ourselves for not right. having a normal love life.
Right.
Even though no one seems to have any of these.
Or not loved perfectly.
Right. So we have this ideal mm-hmm. of what love is, and then these very, very unhelpful narratives of love, and they're in everywhere. You know, they're in movies and songs, and we mustn't blame songs and movies too much, but if you say to people, look, love is a painful, poignant, touching attempt by two flawed individuals to try and meet each other's needs in situations of gross uncertainty and ignorance about who they are and who the other person is, but, you know, we're going to do our best, that's a much more generous starting point. So the acceptance of ourselves as flawed creatures seems to me what love really is. Love is at its most necessary when we are weak, when we feel incomplete, and we must show love to one another at those points. So mm-hmm. we've got these two contrasting stories, and we get them muddled.
Well, and also, I mean, and you know, I feel like this should be obvious, but you just touched on art and culture and how that could help us complexify our understanding of this. And one of the things you point out, about When Harry Met Sally or Four Weddings and a Funeral, one of the things that's wrong with all of that is that a lot of these sorts take us up to the wedding. They take us through the falling and don't see that. I think you've written somewhere, you said a wiser culture than ours would recognize that the start of a relationship is not the high point that romantic art assumes. It is merely the first step of a far longer, more ambivalent and yet quietly audacious journey on which we should direct our intelligence and scrutiny.
That's right. I mean, we are strangely obsessed by the run-up to love. And what we call a love story is really just the beginning of love story, but we leave that out. Mm-hmm. And so, but you know, most of us, we're interested in long-term relationships. We're not just interested in the moment that gets us into love. We're interested in the survival of love over time.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what you are pointing at, the work of loving over a long span of time, is inner work, right? and it'd be hard to film that. But, you know, I'm very intrigued by how you talk about the ancient Greeks and their pedagogical view of love.
Right? Yes, I mean, that's fascinating, mm-hmm. because one of the greatest insults that you can level at a lover in the modern world, apparently, is to say, I want to change you.
Yeah.
The ancient Greeks had a view of love which was essentially based around education. That what love means, love is a benevolent process whereby two people try to teach each other how to become the best versions of themselves.
Now you say somewhere they're committed to increasing the admirable characteristics that they possess and the other person possesses.
That's right. That's right.
Which is a twist on changing you. I mean, it is.
And that what love
is. It is. Right.
Yes. No, absolutely.
You know, there's your most recent book on this subject is The Course of Love, which is a novel. But it's a novel that actually, I feel, you kind of weave a pedagogical narrator voice into it. Do you think that's fair?
Woven into the
narrative. And, you know, you say at one point, this is the relationship between Robbie and, Kirsten. And, you know, you said at one point, their relationship is secretly yet mutually marked by a project of improvement, which I think we all recognize. And then there's this moment where you say, after the dinner party, Robbie is sincerely trying to bring about an evolution in the personality of the wife he loves. But his chosen technique is distinctive: to call Kirsten materialistic, to shout at her, and then later to slam two doors.
That's right. And of course, by the time you humiliate, by the time we've humiliated someone, they're not going to learn anything. Yeah. The only conditions, as we know with children, the only conditions under which anyone learns are conditions of incredible sweetness, tenderness, patience. That's how we learn.
Yeah.
But the problem is that, you know, the failures of our relationships have made us so anxious that we can't be the teachers we should be. And therefore, some often, you know, genuine, legitimate things that we want to get across are just, you know, come across as insults, as attempts to wound, and are therefore rejected. And, you know, the arteries of the relationship start to fur.
Yeah. Someone recently said to me, I'm curious about how you respond to this. You know, it was a wise Jewish mother who had said to them, men marry women with the idea that they will stay the same. Women marry men with the idea that they will change, which is obviously a huge generalization, but it made a lot of sense to me, even in terms of my own life, in terms of what I see around me.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that both genders want to change mm-hmm. one another, and they both have an idea of who the lover should be.
Yeah. Right.
And I think, you know, a useful exercise that sometimes psychologists, level at feuding couples is they say things like, if you could accept that your partner would never change, how would you feel about that? Sometimes pessimism, a certain degree of pessimism, can be a friend of love.
Yeah.
Once we accept that actually it's really very hard for people to be another way, we're sometimes readier. You know, we don't need people to be perfect is the good news. We just need people to be able to explain their imperfections to us in good time before they've hurt us too much with them. And with a certain degree of humility.
Mm.
That's already an enormous step.
It's a lot to ask, but it sounds reasonable, right? I mean, if we could really have that in our minds early enough on in a relationship.
Mm. That's right. Mm-hmm. And you know, almost from the first date,
yeah.
My view of what one should talk about on a first date is not showing off or not you know, putting forward one's accomplishments, but almost quite the opposite. You know, one should say, well, how are you crazy? I'm crazy like this.
Right.
You know, and there should be a mutual acceptance that two damaged people are trying to get together, because right. pretty much all of us, there are a few totally healthy people, but pretty much all of us reach dating age with, you know, some scars, some wounds. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we bring to adult relationships some of the same hope yeah. that a young child might have had of their parent. And of course, an adult relationship can't be like that. It's got to accept that the person across the table or on the other side of the bed is just human, which means full of flaws, fears, right. etc., and not some sort of superhuman.
Yeah, and I think that question that you said could be a standard question on an early date, and how are you crazy? There's also something that you're getting at that it almost seems like we must be hardwired to do this. Although, you know, one of the wonderful things we're learning in the 21st century is that we can change our brains. But the way you say it in On Love, in a scene in On Love, is, you know, boy meets girl and they, you start to be enamored in details of this new person and find things in common. Like, I don't know, both of us had two large freckles on the toe of the left foot. And then he wrote, you know, instinctively, and this happens very quickly, he teases out an entire personality from the details. But also, I what I know from my own life is you tend to, I think we, when we fall in love with another person, we magnify in our minds those things that are immediately enrapturing. And craft our idea of the other person almost exclusively around those wonderful qualities, which is not fair to them or to us.
That's right. And, we, you know, we feel in a way that we know them already and we impose
on
them an idea.
Right.
And we don't. Which, you know, also explains another phenomenon that I'm fascinated by. You probably would have noticed in both novels is the phenomenon of being in a sulk, of sulking. Because sulking is a fascinating situation which takes you right into the heart of certain romantic delusions. Because what's fascinating about sulking is that we don't sulk with everybody. We only get into sulks with people that we feel should understand us, but rather unforgivably haven't understood us.
Oh,
so in other words, it's when we are in love with people and they're in love with us that we take particular offense when they get things wrong. Because the kind of the governing assumption of the relationship is this person should know what's in my mind, ideally without me needing to tell them.
Yes.
If I need to spell this out to you, you don't love me. And that's why, you know, you'll go into the bathroom, bolt the door, and when your partner says, you know, is anything wrong, you'll go, mm-mm. And the reason is that they should be able to read through the bathroom panel into your soul and know what's wrong.
Right.
And that's such an extraordinary demand.
So unfair, yes.
we see it in children. I mean, this is how little children behave. They literally think that their parents can read their minds. It takes a long time to realize that the only way that one person can really learn about another is if it's explained to them, preferably using words,
use your words.
Calm ones.
What do you say to children?
But, you know, when people always say communicate, I mean, you know, we have to be generous towards the reasons why we don't. Mm-hmm. And we don't because we're operating with this mad idea that true love means intuitive understanding. And, you know, I go crazy. When people say things like, I met someone, you know, the loveliest thing is they understood me without me needing to speak. You know, and I thought, oh, so many alarm bells go off when I hear that because I think, okay, well, good luck for, you know, good luck in this instance. But, you know, if you guys get together, that's not going to go on forever. No one can, you know, intuitively understand another beyond a quite limited range of topics.
Right. Your children, how old are your children? They're still pretty young, right? Are they?
Yeah, they're 10 and 12.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I, you know, as the now that I have young adult children, when you hear that coming out of the mouth of your 21-year-old, you know, he should know. He should just know.
Right.
And you just, but I also know is that grasping this, what you're talking about is, it is the work of life, right? It is the work of growing up.
It's the work of love. And, you know, but it's interesting that you know, you're mentioning your children and children generally, because I think it sounds eerie, but I think that one of the kindest things that we can do with our lover is to see them as children, and not to infantilize them, but when we're dealing with children as parents, as adults, we're incredibly generous in the way we interpret their behavior. And if a child says, if you walk home and a child says, "I hate you," right, you immediately go, okay, that's not quite true. Probably they're tired, they're hungry, something's gone wrong, someone, their tooth hurts, something. We're looking around for a benevolent interpretation that can just shave off some of the more, you know, depressing, dispiriting aspects of their behavior. Yeah. And we do this naturally with children, and yet we do it so seldom with adults. You know, when an adult meets an adult and they say, you know, "I don't know, I've not had a good day, leave me alone," rather than saying, okay, I'm just going to go behind the facade of this slightly depressing comment.
And understand that that's actually not about me, that's about what's going on inside them today.
Right, exactly. We don't do that. We take it all completely personally. And so I think, you know, the work of love is to try, when we can manage it, we can't always, to go behind the front of this rather, you know, depressing, challenging behavior and try and ask where it might have come from. You know, love is doing that work to ask oneself, where's this rather aggressive, pained, non-communicative, unpleasant behavior come from? If we can do that, we're on the road to knowing a little bit about what love really is, I think.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, a conversation about love with writer and philosopher Alain de Botton.
I'd love to talk about you used this word pessimism a little while ago, and I'd love to dig into that a little bit more. And what you're really talking about is being reality-based as opposed to being ideal-based. There's a beautiful video that I've shared that's out there. I think it's The Darkest Truth About Love. Is that right? That's the title, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
From
exactly.
School of Life, made that for YouTube.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk through, you know, some of these core truths that fly in the face of this way we go around behaving and that movies have taught us to behave and that possibly our parents taught us to behave. These core truths that can put us on the foundation of reality.
Yes. I mean, that's very useful. We could chisel them in granite. I mean, look, one of the first important truths is you're crazy. Not you, as it were, all of us. That all of us are deeply damaged people.
Right.
The great enemy of love, good relationships, good friendships is self-righteousness. If we start by accepting that, of course, we're, you know, only just holding it together and in many ways really quite challenging people. You know, I think if somebody thinks that they're easy to live with, they're by definition going to be pretty hard and don't have much of an understanding of themselves. I think, you know, there's certain wisdom that begins by knowing that, of course, you, like everyone else, is pretty difficult. And of course, this knowledge is very shielded from us. You know, our parents don't tell us, our ex-lovers, they knew it, but they couldn't be bothered to tell us. They you know, sacked us without...
Well, by the time they tell us, we're dismissing what they say anyway.
Well, that's right. And our friends don't tell us because they just want a pleasant evening with us. So we're left with, you know, a bubble of ignorance about our own natures. And often, you know, you can be way into your 40s before you're starting to get a sense of, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe some of the problem is in me. Because, of course, you know, it's so intuitive to think that, of course, it's the other person. So to begin with that sense of, you know, I'm quite tricky in these ways, that's a very important starting point for being good at love. Mm. You know, so often we blame our lovers, we don't blame our view of love. And so we keep sacking our lovers and blowing up relationships or in pursuit of this idea of love, which actually has no basis in reality. It's simply not rooted in anything we know.
This right person, this creature does not exist.
And is in fact the enemy of good enough relationships. You know, I'm really fond of Donald Winnicott, this English psychoanalyst's term, which he first used in relation to parenting, that, you know, what we should be aiming for is not perfection, but a good enough situation. And it's wonderfully downbeat. You know, no one would go, you know, what are your hopes this year? Well, I just want to have a good enough relationship. People would go, oh, I'm sorry your life's so grim. But you want to go, no, that's really good. That's kind of, for a human, that's brilliant. Yeah. And that's, I think, the attitude we should have.
Yeah. You know, one of the darkest truth about love, you know, you say the idea of love, in fact, distracts us from existential loneliness. You know, you are irredeemably alone. You will not be understood. But also behind that is the, right, these are, as you say, the, these are dark truths, but it's also a relief, as truth always ultimately is, if we can hear it, that, again, that is the work of life, is to reckon.
Yes, that's right. I mean,
what goes on inside us.
I think one of the greatest sorrows we sometimes have in love is the feeling that our lover doesn't understand parts of us. Mm. And a certain kind of bravery, a certain heroic acceptance of loneliness seems to be one of the key ingredients to being able to form a good relationship.
Isn't that interesting? And it sounds paradoxical.
Of course. Yeah. If you expect that your lover must understand everything about mm-hmm. you'll be furious pretty much all the time. Mm-hmm. There are islands and moments of beautiful connection, but we have to be modest about how often they're going to happen. I think, you know, if you're lonely with only, 40% of your life, that's really good going. You may not want to, be lonely with over 50%, but, mm-hmm. I think there's certainly a sizable minority share of your life which you're going to have to endure without echo from those you love.
Yeah. You know, I debated over whether I would discuss this with you, but I think I will. Like, I'm single right now and have been for a few years, and it's actually been a great joy. You know, not that I think I will be single forever or want to be single forever, although actually I think I would be all right if I were, which is a real watershed. And also what this part of this chapter of life has taught me to really enjoy more deeply and take more seriously all the many forms of love in life, aside from just, the romantic love or being coupled.
Well, it's funny because, just as you were saying.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, just as you were saying, I'm single. I was about to say you're not,
no,
because
right.
we have to look at what this idea of singlehood is. I mean, mm-hmm. we've got this word single, which captures somebody
but
who's
I have
not
so much
got a long term relationship.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
And another way of looking at love is connection. Mm-hmm. We're all the time, we are hardwired to seek connections with others, and that is in a sense at a kind of granular level what love is. Love is connection, and insofar mm-hmm. as one is alive and one is in relatively buoyant spirit some of the time, it's because we are connected. And we can take pride in how flexible our minds ultimately are about where that connection is coming. And I think it's also worth saying that, for some people, relationships are not necessarily the place where they encounter their best selves.
Yeah. Yeah.
That actually the person that they are in a relationship is not the person that they want to be, or that they can be in other areas of life, that they feel that there are other possibilities that they'd like to explore.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think getting into a relationship with someone, asking someone to be with you is a pretty cruel thing to do to someone that you love and admire and respect, because the job is so hard. Mm-hmm. Most people fail at it. When you ask someone to marry you, for example, you're asking someone to, be your chauffeur, co-host, sexual partner, co-parent, fellow accountant, mop the kitchen floor together, etc., etc. And on the list goes. No wonder that we fail at some of the tasks and get irate with one another. It's a burden. And I think sometimes, the older I get, sometimes I think one of the nicest things you can do to someone that you really admire is leave them alone. just let them go. Let them be. Don't impose yourself on them, because you're challenging.
I want to read this definition of marriage that you've written in a few places. I think it's wonderful, and just talk about this. Marriage ends up as a hopeful, generous, infinitely kind gamble taken by two people who don't know yet who they are or who the other might be, binding themselves to a future they cannot conceive of and have carefully avoided investigating.
Well, yes, it's challenging, and it's certainly contrary to the romantic view. But
yes.
Again, this kind of realism or, acceptance of complexity, I think, is ultimately the friend of love. I'm not, look, it's also worth adding, I don't believe that everybody should stay in exactly the relationship that they're in, and that any relationship is worth sticking with, and that in a way the fault is always the fault of the lovers if it's not, or both lovers if it's not happy. there are legitimate reasons to leave a relationship. But mm-hmm. when you're really being honest, if you ask yourself, why am I in pain? And you can't necessarily attribute all the sorrows that you're feeling to your lover. If you recognize that some of those things are perhaps endemic to existence or endemic to all human beings or something within yourself, then what you're doing is encountering the pain of life with another person, mm-hmm. but not necessarily because of another person.
And for example, I mean, you are in fact arguing, as you said before, some marriages are meant to end, and there's certainly reasons for marriages to end or to end marriages. But you also point out this very contradictory fact that the thing that's ultimately wrong with adultery as an easy out to what's going wrong in the marriage is that it is based on the same idealism that certain ideas of marriage are based on that go wrong.
That's right, in a way that you're just redirecting your hope elsewhere. And
imagine this is the perfect one, right? This is the one person who won't, with whom you won't be ever be lonely again, who will understand you completely.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so it's, on and on, the cycles of hurt continue.
Mm. You know, something else you name about marriage that I feel is not often enough just named is that, we spoke a little while ago about children coming into a marriage and of course, children teach us so much. I mean, one thing you say that's beautiful, the children teach us that love in its purest form is a kind of service. The love we have for our children, I mean, I certainly notice with myself, the love that I have for my children has changed me, and it is distinct from all the other loves I've ever known. But also that the children are hard on marriages, right? And for, I think, on a more complicated level, if there are problems in the marriage, that can get amplified when children are there. It's also partly just because you get, everybody's tired, right?
That's right. It's interesting. I mean, in a way, there's a lot of mundanity in relationships. And one of the things that romanticism does is to teach us that, the great love stories should be above the mundane. Mm-hmm. So, in none of the great, say, 19th century novels about love, does anyone ever do the laundry? Does anyone pick up the crumbs from the kitchen table? Does anyone ever, clean the bathroom? It just doesn't happen because it's assumed that what makes or breaks love are just feelings, passionate emotions, not the kind of day-to-day wear and tear. And yet, of course, when we find ourselves in relationships, it is precisely over these areas that conflicts arise, but we refuse to lend them the necessary prestige. I mean, there's no arguments as vicious as when two people are arguing about something, but both of them think the argument is trivial. So they'll say things like, it's just, it's absurd. We're arguing over, who should hang up the towels in the bathroom. Right, that's for stupid people.
That has nothing to do with it.
Right. And you know that that's going to be trouble. And so we need, in a way, one of the sort of, one of the lessons of love is to lend a bit of prestige to those issues that crop up in love, like, who does the laundry and on what day? We rush over these decisions. We don't see them as legitimate. We think it's fine to...
Yeah.
But they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you say, there's a lot of life
that is the stuff of life, extremely
mundane.
Right. It's the stuff of our days. I mean, there's this wonderful line from The Course of Love about, these two parents with children. The tired child inside each of them is furious at how long it has been neglected and in pieces.
That's right. And, in a way... It's so funny. If I can be indiscreet on air, my wife's used to say to me in the early days of our marriage, she sometimes would say to me things like, my father would never have said something like this. And I would say something, or so I'm it's not my turn to make the tea or something. She'll go, my father would never have said it. He would always do this for us. Mm-hmm. And then I had to point out that there was really she wasn't comparing like with like, that she was comparing this man, her father, as a father, but not as a lover. Yeah. And, in the end, what I wanted to say to her, did end up saying to her, was, in a way, I'm probably behaving exactly like your father, but just not the father that you saw when he was around you.
Yeah, the way he behaved towards your mother.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Exactly. And so one of the things we do as parents is to edit mm-hmm. ourselves, mm-hmm. Which is lovely in a way for our children, but it gives our children a really unnatural sense of what you can expect from another human being, because we're never as nice to probably anyone else on earth as we are to our children. I mean, I'm saying this is the cost of good parenting.
You can listen again and share this conversation with Alain de Botton through our website, onbeing.org. I'm Krista Tippett. On Being continues in a moment. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today we're exploring the true hard work of love with the writer and philosopher Alain de Botton.
You know, I'd like to go a slightly different place with all of this. You know, I've been the things you've been saying, pointing out about how love really works, that people don't learn when they're humiliated, that self-righteousness is an enemy of love. I'm thinking a lot right now these days about how and if we could apply the intelligence we actually have with the experience of love, not the ideal, but the experience of love in our lives, to how we can be as citizens moving forward, where there's a lot of behavior in public. I mean, I'm speaking for the United States, but I think there are forms of this in the UK as well. We're kind of acting out in public the way we act out at our worst in relationships.
I think that's fascinating. I think you're onto something huge and rather counterintuitive, because we associate the word love with private life. We don't associate it with life in the republic, with civil society.
Yes.
But I think that a functioning society requires two things that are, again, just don't sound very normal, but they require love and politeness.
Yes.
And by love, I mean a capacity to enter imaginatively into the minds of people with whom you don't immediately agree, and to look for the more charitable explanations for behavior which doesn't appeal to you and which could seem plain wrong, not just to chuck them immediately in prison or to haul them up in front of a law court, but to also...
Or tell them how stupid they are, right?
Exactly, because we're permanently, you know, all sides are attempting to show how stupid every other side is. And the other thing, of course, is politeness, which is an attempt not necessarily to say everything, to understand that there is a role for private feelings, which, if they were to emerge, would do damage to everyone concerned. But we've got this culture of kind of self-disclosure. And as I say, it spills out into politics as well. The same dynamic goes on of like, if I'm not telling you exactly what I think, then, you know, I may develop a twitch or an illness from not expunging my feelings. And you know, to which I would say, no, you're not. You're preserving, you know, the peace and, good nature of the republic. And it's absolutely what you should be doing.
Yes. And I guess, you know, I've been having this conversation with a lot of people this year. I mean, the truth is, more than ever before, perhaps, in our world, we are in relationship, right? We are connected to everyone else. And that's a fact. Their well-being will impact our well-being, is of relevance to our well-being and that of our children. But we have this habit and this capacity in public to, and it's also, we know that our brains work this way, right? To see the other, to see those strangers, those people on the other side, politically, socioeconomically, whatever. Forgetting that in our intimate lives and in our love lives, you know, in our circles of family and friends and in our marriages and with our children, there are things about the people we love the most who drive us crazy that we do not comprehend, and yet we find ways to be intelligent, right? To be loving, because it gets a better result.
That's right. And you know, families are at this kind of testbed of love because, well, we can't entirely quit them. And this is what makes families so fascinating, because you're thrown together with a group of people who you would never pick if you could simply pick on the grounds of, you know, compatibility. You know, compatibility is an achievement of love.
Right.
It shouldn't be the precondition of love, as we nowadays, in a slightly spoiled way, imagine it must be.
Yes, wonderful. I think this is deeply politically relevant, and it's
totally. I think, you know, if we just try and explore the word political really means you know, outside of private space. Mm-hmm. And we're highly socialized creatures who really take our cues from what is going on around us. And if we see an atmosphere of short tempers, of selfishness, etc., that will bolster those capacities within ourselves. If we see charity being exercised, if we see good humor, if we see forgiveness on display, again, it will lend support to those sides of ourselves. And, you know, we need to take care what we're exposing ourselves to, because too much exposure to, you know, the opposite of love, you know, makes us into very hostile and angry people.
Yes, and I think it's also such an important thing to bear in mind, that the import of our conduct moment to moment, that is having effects that we can't see.
That's right. We're far more sensitive than we allow for. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we need to build a world that recognizes that if somebody goes, you know, mm-hmm, rather than this, or thanks rather than yes, or, you know, whatever it is, this can ruin our day. And we should think about that as we approach not just our personal relationships, but also our social and political relationships. These things are humiliating. Little things can deeply wound and humiliate. You know, let's not forget that one of the things that makes relationships so scary is we need to be weak in front of other people. And yes. most of us are just experts at being pretty strong. You know, we've been doing it for years. Yeah. We know how to be strong. What we don't know how to do is to make ourselves safely vulnerable. And so we tend to get very twitchy, you know, preternaturally aggressive, etc., when we're asked to, you know, when the moment has come to be weak.
And I feel like there's almost this calling now, because the stakes are so high, for emotional intelligence in public, which of course none of us gets perfectly in our intimate lives, but we do know these things about people we love, and they're also true of people we don't know and don't think we love. But I want to return a little bit to love and sex and Eros and all of this. I have to say, one thing I really love and appreciate and learned from in your writing is your reflection on flirting, as an art, the art of flirting, that it can be something edifying, a pleasurable gift, and you have this phrase, a good flirt. So would you describe what a good flirt is?
Well, you know, if we think about what flirtation is, in many ways, flirtation is the attempt to awaken somebody else to their attractiveness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, it would be such a pity if we had to drive something as important as kind of validation and self-acceptance and, you know, a pleasant view of oneself through the gate of, rather narrow gate of sex. And flirtation is a kind of act of the imagination. And, you know, what's fun about flirtation is that it often happens between really quite unlikely people.
Yeah.
You know, two people meet and, you know, maybe they're both with someone, or there's a, you know, difference in status or background, etc. And they can find that they're in a little conversation about the weather, and both parties will recognize there's something a little bit flirtatious going on. Mm-hmm. And it's got really nothing to do with sex as such. It's just two people delighting in awakening one another to the fact that they're quite nice people, and they're quite attractive, and that's okay.
Yeah, you also have this one lovely film. It's one of these School of Life films about this. You know, a good flirt. You can make these assumptions that this other person, you know, maybe would love to sleep with us, won't sleep with us, and the reason why they won't has nothing to do with any deficiency on our part. But it's also not, as you say, a deception. It's a natural, pleasurable human experience.
That's right. I mean, the other thing that we get quite wrong in our culture is the whole business of what sex actually is. Mm. You know, because we've come kind of from a Freudian world. You know, Freud has told us that there's a lot more going on in sex than we want to believe, and that a lot of it is quite weird and darker than we'd ever want to imagine, and that sex is everywhere in life, even in places where we don't think it is or perhaps should be. But in a way, I've got a sort of different view of this. I think that it's not so much that sex is everywhere, it's that psychological dynamics are everywhere, even in sex. And so often we think of sex as just a sort of pneumatic activity, but really it's a psychological activity. And if you try to imagine why people are excited by sex, It's not so much that it's a pleasurable, nerve-ending business. It's ultimately that it's about acceptance. If you think about why is it exciting to kiss someone for the first time? It's not, it's probably more fun eating an oyster or flossing your teeth or watching TV than kissing. I mean, it's a bit weird. What's this odd thing we call kissing? It's like sort of trying to inflate somebody else's mouth. I mean, it's just odd. Yet, nevertheless, we like it, not because of its physical feeling, but because of what it means, the meaning we infuse. And the meaning we infuse into it is, I accept you. And I accept you in a way that is incredibly intimate and that would be quite revolting with anyone else. I'm allowing you into my private space as a way of signaling, I like you. Mm-hmm. And what really, we call it getting turned on, but what we really are, as it were, excited by is that someone accepts us with remarkable,
It takes delight in us.
Right. It takes delight in us. Yeah. And that's what's exciting about it. In other words, sex is continuous with a lot of things that we're interested in outside of the bedroom.
And you say that flirting, is one way to experience in the course of ordinary life in a way that's completely non-threatening to whatever your commitments are. What is enjoyable about sex that's not necessarily the act itself, the fact that we are sexual beings.
That's right. That's right. Mm. But we feel often conflicted about it. I shouldn't be flirting. I can't flirt, etc. So there's a lot of fear of there's a lot of fear of slippery slopes. In many situations we can hang on the slippery slope. It's okay. We've got tools to hang on in there.
Yeah. I want to know. I don't want to let you go before asking what you think about, what's your view of online dating, because this is a new way that so many people, perhaps most people, moving forward, are meeting, are engaging this romantic side of themselves.
Look, I mean, at one level, online dating promises to open up something absolutely wonderful, which is a more logical way of getting together with someone. The sort of dream is that the secrets of our soul and the secrets of somebody else's soul will be sort of downloaded onto a computer and that we will find the best possible match for who we are. The darker side of online dating is that it encourages the idea that a good relationship must mean a conflict-free relationship, and therefore any relationship which has conflict in it, which has unhappiness and areas of tension in it, is wrong and can be terminated because we have this wonderful backup, which is alternatives. So like any tool, it's got its pluses and minuses and has to be used correctly. And I think what I mean by correctly is it has to broaden the pool of people from which we're choosing our lovers, while not giving us the illusion that there is such a thing as a perfect human being.
Right. So then you're back to the basic truth, the darker truth about love. Also that what online dating does, it is introduces you to people, but then is really the whole thrust of your thinking is it's that loving is really what comes next, right? It's what comes after the meeting.
That's right. Silicon Valley has been incredibly interested in getting us to that first stage of meeting the person. And, that's great. But the next stage has been abandoned. Where is the app that will tell you how to read, how to interpret somebody else's confused signals of distress, or that will remind you at a certain point to, look charitably upon, someone's behavior because you remember their childhood, etc. So we have a long way to go. Our technology is still, it sounds odd because it's one of the sort of narcissisms of our time that we think we're living late on in the history of the world. And we think we're sort of, we're right. latecomers to the party that's begun. We're still at the very beginning of understanding ourselves as, human emotional creatures. We're still, taking our first baby steps in the understanding of love. And we need a lot of compassion for ourselves. And no wonder we make horrific mistakes, pretty much all the time.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, a conversation about love with writer and philosopher Alain de Botton. I happened to see your tweet at the end of 2016 when the New York Times released its most read articles of the year. And your "Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person" was number one, which is really extraordinary. I mean, the most read article in a year of the Brexit vote, the presidential election, war, refugee crisis. I wonder what that tells you about us as a species.
It was deeply fascinating and quite extraordinary. And apparently it was first by a long way. I mean, it's just peculiar.
Yes. And
I think that, first of all, it tells us that we have an enormous loneliness around our difficulties. Mm. One could write a follow-on piece, I may or may not, called "Why You Will Get Into the Wrong Job," which would probably score quite highly too. Mm. And, "Why You'll Have the Wrong Child," and "Why You'll Go on the Wrong Vacation," and "Why Your Body Will Be the Wrong Shape," and "Why You'll Think You Live in the Wrong Country," etc. And, in a way, we need solace for the sense that we have gone wrong in an area, whatever it may be, where perfection was possible. And anyone who comes along and says, it's normal that you are suffering, life is suffering, is doing a quite unusual thing in our culture, which is so much about optimism. Mm. It sounds grim. It is, in fact, enormously consoling and alleviating and helpful in a culture which is oppressive in its demands for perfection. So, I think a certain kind of pessimistic realism, which is totally compatible with hope, totally compatible with laughter, good humor, a sense of fun. It's not, it doesn't have to be.
It's how comedy and tragedy belong together.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, I'm a great fan of gallows humor. I mean, we're all on the way to the gallows in one way or another. And, we can hug and give each other laughs and point out the more pleasant sides as we head towards the scaffold.
That may be your last word. I just want to ask you, we first began to speak about On Love, which you wrote, I think, which was published when you were 23 in the late 90s. You've now been married for over a dozen years. And, what did you really not know? I mean, and that book was so wise. And in fact, that book that you published when you were 23, On Love, really presented a lot of the themes you've carried forward in time. But I do wonder, what you really did not know, what you've learned, what you continue to learn about love at this stage in your life.
I genuinely thought at that time that problems in love are the result of being with people who are, in one way or another, defective. Mm. And, in 2002, this belief was severely tested in that I met someone who was really absolutely wonderful in every way. And through much effort, I pursued her and eventually married her and discovered something very surprising. She was great in a million ways. She was very right. And yet, oddly, there were all sorts of problems. And I think it's been, the path that I've been on to realize that those problems had nothing to do with her being a deficient person, or indeed with me being a horribly deficient person. They were to do with the challenges of being a human being trying to relate to another human being in a loving relationship, that I was encountering some endemic issues that every couple, however well matched, and there is no such thing as a perfect match, but however well matched, every couple will encounter these problems, that love is something we have to learn and we can make progress with, and that it's not just an enthusiasm, it's a skill, and it requires forbearance, generosity, imagination, and a million things besides. And we must fiercely resist the idea that true love must mean conflict-free love, that the course of true love is smooth. It's not. The course of true love is rocky and bumpy at the best of times. That's the best we can manage as the creatures we are. It's no fault of mine or no fault of yours. It's to do with being human. And the more generous we can be towards that flawed humanity, the better chance we'll have of doing the true hard work of love.
A Alain de Botton is the founder and chairman of the School of Life. His books include Religion for Atheists, How Proust Can Change Your Life, and the novel The Course of Love. Love takes many forms. And as Alain de Botton and I discussed, there's more love in our lives than we often name that way. At On Being, we've teamed up with some incredible artists at Bear Fox Chalk to craft hand-illustrated postcards, each with a quote evoking one of four varieties of love, from romance to celebrating a friend to honoring someone who makes the world around them a more loving place. So head over to Instagram.com/onbeing and fill in a little about one of those people in your life. We'll mail them a hand-designed quote card in your name. We're calling this celebration #4KindsOfLove. It's our gift to you. On Being is
Trent Gilliss, Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Mariah Helgeson,
Maya Tarrell,
Marie Sambalay,
Bethany Mann,
Selena Carlson,
and Rixar Wangchuk.
Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice you hear singing our final credits in each show is hip-hop artist Lizzo. On Being was created at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at Fetzer.org. Kalliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. The Henry Luce Foundation, in support of public theology reimagined. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and is a Krista Tippett public production.